A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
The most engineered object you pass at 70 miles an hour without ever seeing it, until a 50-year wind gust hits a gantry at 110 miles an hour, or a taxiway sign fails in fog at Heathrow. Daniel's been thinking about signage again. Last time, he asked who came up with the visual language, the stop signs, the pictograms, the whole system of what signs say. Today, he wants the other half of the problem. How do you keep a 40-foot aluminum sign bolted to a steel truss over 8 lanes of traffic in a windstorm? How do you make a taxiway sign that destroys itself on impact, rather than tearing open a 747's wing? And how do you keep any of it readable at 50 below in the Arctic, or in desert heat where the surface of the sign hits 85 Celsius and vinyl sheeting turns to dust in 18 months?
The thing is, most people never separate those two problems. The visual language and the physical engineering. The MUTCD, the Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices, that's the U.S. Bible for what signs say and where they go. First published 1935, now on its 11th edition. And internationally, you've got the Vienna Convention on Road Signs and Signals, 1968, standardized pictograms across more than 70 countries. The U.S. never ratified it, but absorbed a lot of its logic anyway. That's all the first problem. The semiotics, the layout, the color coding. Today we're doing the second problem, and it's the one almost nobody writes about.
So we're talking about the stuff that holds the signs up and keeps them readable in conditions that would destroy most materials in a season. And Daniel mentioned a few things specifically. Highway gantries, airport signage, and then extreme environments, the military bases in the far north, and the desert installations where the UV alone would chew through standard materials in a couple of years.
Let's start with the biggest signs you'll ever see, the ones you drive under at 70 miles an hour. A typical overhead sign bridge on a U.S. interstate spans 40 to 80 feet. That's a custom-engineered steel truss structure, not an off-the-shelf product. Every single one is designed for the specific site, the span, the number of lanes, the local wind loads.
Custom-engineered. So when I'm driving on the I-95 and I pass under one of those giant green signs, somebody sat down and did the math for that exact gantry.
Somebody did finite element analysis for that exact gantry. The wind load is calculated for a 50-year storm event, typically 90 to 110 mile-per-hour gusts depending on where you are. And the sign panels themselves, those big green aluminum sheets, they're 3/16 inch aluminum with extruded stiffener ribs every 24 inches. It's basically aircraft skin construction. If you ever get close to one, and you mention standing next to one in Mitzpeh Ramon, you know this. They're enormous. A single panel can be 12 feet tall and 20 feet wide, and without those stiffener ribs, it'd flap like a sheet of paper in the wind.
I remember that. You see them from the car and they look sign-sized. Then you're standing under one and it's the size of a billboard. The fastening is what I want to get at, though. Daniel specifically asked how these things are secured, and the answer can't just be bolts.
It's bolts, but the bolts are doing a lot more work than people realize. The standard fasteners are ASTM A325 or A490 high-strength steel bolts, torqued to specific values, typically around 450 foot-pounds for the anchor bolts. That's the kind of torque you need, a pneumatic impact wrench for, and you calibrate the wrench every morning. The gantry to foundation connection uses anchor bolts embedded 4 to 6 feet into reinforced concrete footings. Every state DOT has standard detailed drawings for these. Texas's are publicly available. They run 40 plus pages per gantry type.
40 pages of drawings for what most people think is just a metal pole with a sign on it.
And those drawings get revised. The big wake-up call for all of this was the I-35W bridge collapse in Minneapolis in 2004. Not a sign gantry, but it triggered AASH2, the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials, to update its fatigue design provisions in 2007. Sign structures now get analyzed for vortex shedding. That's the same physics that makes power lines hum in the wind. Wind hits the sign panel, creates alternating vortices on the downstream side, and that sets up an oscillation. Over time, that cyclic loading causes fatigue cracks at the bolt holes. That's the number one failure mode, not a single big gust, but thousands of small vibrations over years.
So the sign is essentially humming in the wind, and the bolts are slowly working loose, or the aluminum around them is developing microscopic cracks.
And you won't see it from the ground. A fatigue crack starts at the edge of a bolt hole, propagates inward, and by the time it's visible on the surface, the bolt has already lost most of its clamping force. That's why inspection cycles exist. The MUTCD recommends every 2 years, but most states do it annually. Somebody drives out there with a torque wrench and checks a sample of bolts on every gantry.
I want to sit with the torque number for a second. 450 foot-pounds. For people who don't live in the world of torque specs, what does that actually mean?
It means if you put a 4-foot cheater bar on your socket wrench and hung 112 pounds off the end of it, that's roughly the force you're applying to one bolt. And there might be 16 of those bolts on a single gantry footing. It's enormous. You're essentially preloading the bolt so that the clamped pieces, the base plate, and the concrete footing are held together with a clamping force higher than any load the wind can apply. The bolt isn't just keeping the sign from falling over, it's squeezing the steel base plate against the concrete hard enough that the joint behaves like one solid piece.
Airport signage is a completely different design philosophy, right? Daniel asked about that specifically.
Completely different. Airport signs are governed by FAA Advisory Circular 150/5344 in the U.S. and ICAO Annex 14 internationally. The fundamental requirement is frangibility. The sign has to break away on impact. A rigid sign hitting a 747's wing at 40 knots is worse than the sign being destroyed. The frangible couplings are engineered shear points, typically aluminum alloy with a calculated failure load around 2,500 pounds. Hit it with the wing of a moving aircraft and the coupling shears clean, the sign collapses, and the aircraft keeps moving.
So highway signs are designed to never fail, and airport signs are designed to fail in a very specific way at a very specific load.
And that's the tension in the engineering. You're designing something that has to survive hurricane force winds and also snap off cleanly if a plane hits it. The way they do it's by putting the weak point in the coupling, not in the sign structure itself. The sign body is rigid, the base is rigid, and there's a precisely machined aluminum collar that connects them. That collar has a groove cut into it at a calculated depth. It's essentially a controlled failure plane. Above 2,500 pounds of side load, it shears. Below that, it holds.
So someone calculated exactly how deep to cut that groove, so it breaks at the right force.
And tested it. The FAA requires physical testing. They literally push a sign over with a hydraulic ram and measure the failure load. The sign also has to be internally illuminated. The FAA mandates a minimum of 25 candela per square meter for internally lit signs, which means LED arrays with redundant power feeds. A sign failure at a taxiway intersection in fog isn't an inconvenience. It's a collision risk. Two aircraft on intersecting taxiways, no visual reference, and suddenly you're relying entirely on radio.
25 candela per square meter. Is that bright? Give me a comparison.
A typical laptop screen at full brightness is around 300 candela per square meter, so it's dimmer than that. But it doesn't need to be bright, it needs to be visible through fog. The candela spec is about the intensity of the light source, not the apparent brightness at distance. In fog, a dimmer, more diffuse light actually performs better than a harsh bright one because there's less backscatter. The sign is designed to be readable from the cockpit at taxi speed, not from across the airfield.
That's a detail I'd never have thought of. Too bright is actually worse in fog.
It's counterintuitive, but it's the same reason you use fog lights on a car, low and diffuse rather than high and focused. The FAA spec accounts for that. And the redundant power feeds. There are typically two independent circuits powering each sign, so if one fails, the sign dims but doesn't go dark. In some installations, there's even a battery backup good for 30 minutes, enough time to get all aircraft clear of the taxiway.
All right. That's how you keep a sign up in a temperate climate. Now let's take the same problem and move it to places where the ground itself moves.
The Arctic is where it gets wild. Take Thule Air Base in Greenland, or Canadian Forces Station Alert. The northernmost permanently inhabited place on Earth. Signs there face three killers. First, UV from 24-hour summer sun. Most people don't think of the Arctic as a UV problem, but when the sun never sets for months, the cumulative exposure is brutal. Second, embrittlement at minus 50 Celsius. Standard aluminum alloys get brittle. Standard vinyl sheeting cracks like glass. Third, ice abrasion from wind-driven snow at 60-plus miles per hour. It's essentially sandblasting the sign surface for months at a time.
So what actually survives that?
Standard aluminum signs with vinyl sheeting fail in under 2 years. The vinyl cracks and delaminates. The solution is a multi-layer composite. You start with a 6061T6 aluminum substrate. That alloy is chosen specifically for its fatigue resistance at low temperatures. Most aluminum alloys get brittle when they're cold, but 6061 holds its toughness down to well below minus 50. On top of that, you apply a ceramic enamel coating, fired on, not adhesive backed. It's essentially glass fused to metal. UV doesn't degrade it because there's nothing organic in it to break down. The pigment is inorganic, metal oxides, and the binder is the glass itself.
Fired on? So we're talking about a kiln process for a road sign.
For a road sign. And then on top of the ceramic enamel, you add a retro-reflective layer made from microprismatic acrylic, the same material used in marine navigation buoys. The microprisms are tiny cube corner reflectors molded into the acrylic sheet. Light goes in, bounces around three faces, comes back out in exactly the direction it came from. That's what makes the sign visible in headlights at night. And the acrylic layer is replaceable. It's the sacrificial surface. When ice abrasion eventually scuffs it up, you peel it off and apply a new sheet without having to replace the whole sign.
So the sign is a sandwich. Aluminum for structure, ceramic for UV protection and color, acrylic for reflectivity, and the acrylic is the part you expect to replace.
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has a field manual for this, TM5-822-12, that covers sign maintenance in Arctic and subarctic conditions. It includes procedures for replacing signs in whiteout conditions using GPS stake positions. You literally drive out to the coordinates, dig out the signpost if it's buried, and swap the panel. The positions are surveyed in summer when you can see what you're doing, and then you navigate to them in winter by GPS because the sign itself might be under 6 feet of snow.
Desert environments are the flip side of the same coin. Daniel mentioned UV turning plastics to dust in a couple of seasons.
Camp Arifjan in Kuwait or remote Australian outback roads. Surface temperatures on a sign can hit 85 Celsius in direct sun. The problem is thermal expansion mismatch. Aluminum expands at about 23 parts per million per degree Celsius. Vinyl sheeting expands at a different rate, closer to 50 to 100 parts per million depending on the formulation. When the sign heats up, the vinyl wants to expand more than the aluminum, but it's bonded to it, so it buckles. Over enough cycles, hot day, cool night, hot day, cool night, the vinyl delaminates from the aluminum entirely. You get bubbles, then cracks, then the whole sheet peels off. Typical lifespan in those conditions is 18 months for a standard sign.
18 months. So you're replacing desert highway signs basically every other year if you use standard materials.
And that's why they don't. The fix is either ceramic enamel, same as the Arctic solution, or powder-coated aluminum with a UV-stable polyester resin. But powder coat has a problem, sandblasting. Desert wind picks up fine sand and essentially bead blasts the sign surface. The powder coat chips, and once moisture gets under the chip, corrosion starts. So ceramic enamel is preferred in most extreme desert installations. It's more expensive up front, but you're not replacing it every 2 years.
What about the posts? In the Arctic, you've got permafrost heave. Daniel mentioned remote bases with seasonal runways. The ground is literally moving under the signs.
Permafrost heave is one of the most difficult civil engineering problems there is. A signpost driven into frozen ground can shift 6 to 12 inches per year as the active layer. The top few feet that thaws in summer and refreezes in winter expands and contracts. The post gets jacked upward a little bit each cycle, and after a few years, it's leaning at a 30-degree angle, or it's pulled right out of the ground.
So you can't just dig a deeper hole?
You can't, because the permafrost goes down hundreds of feet, and you don't want to thaw it. If you dig into permafrost and introduce heat, from concrete curing, from the building above it, from anything, you create a thaw bulb, and then the ground turns to mud and everything sinks. The solution is a helical screw anchor. It looks like a giant corkscrew, and it's driven 15 to 20 feet down into the permafrost with a hydraulic motor. The helical plates bite into the frozen soil, and the shaft is isolated from the active layer by a sleeve, so the heaving soil at the surface can't grab it. On top of that, you often add a thermal siphon, a sealed tube filled with a refrigerant, usually ammonia or carbon dioxide, that passively transfers heat out of the ground.
Wait. A refrigerant tube? Explain that.
A thermal siphon is a passive device, no moving parts. It's a sealed tube with the bottom end embedded in the permafrost and the top end exposed to the cold air above. When the air temperature is colder than the ground temperature, the refrigerant at the bottom evaporates, rises to the top, condenses against the cold tube wall, and drips back down. That cycle pulls heat out of the ground and dumps it into the air. It only works when the air is colder than the ground, which in the Arctic is most of the year. The result is that the permafrost around the anchor stays frozen year-round, even in summer. Same technology used for the Trans-Alaska pipeline supports.
So, the signpost is essentially sitting on a refrigerated foundation that keeps the ground frozen solid underneath it.
And that's what it takes to keep a sign vertical in the far north. It's the same sign you'd see on a highway in Ohio. Same dimensions, same color, same retro-reflective sheeting, but the foundation underneath, it's a feat of thermal engineering that cost tens of thousands of dollars.
The sign looks the same. That's the part that gets me. You're driving on some gravel road near a remote base, and you see a standard stop sign, and you have no idea there's a 20-foot corkscrew and a refrigerant tube underneath it.
That's the whole point of the episode, really. The visual language is identical everywhere. That's the Vienna Convention's legacy. But the engineering underneath is radically different depending on where you are. In Minnesota, you're worried about wind fatigue on the bolt holes. In Kuwait, you're worried about thermal expansion delaminating the sign face. In Greenland, you're worried about the ground swallowing the post. Same sign, three completely different failure pattern, three completely different engineering solutions.
Maintenance cycles. How often are these things actually checked in extreme environments?
In the continental U.S., most states inspect annually, even though the MUTCD only recommends every 2 years. In extreme environments, it's quarterly. The Army Corps of Engineers manual specifies quarterly inspections for Arctic installations, and after major storm events, which in the Arctic can mean a blizzard that deposited 6 feet of drifted snow on top of the sign. The inspection isn't just, is the sign still there? They check bolt torque, they check the retroreflective sheeting with a retroreflectometer, a handheld device that measures how much light bounces back, and they check the foundation for heave or settlement.
There's a handheld device for measuring how reflective a sign is.
It's called a retroreflectometer. You hold it up to the sign, it shoots a beam of light at a standardized angle, and it measures what comes back. The MUTCD specifies minimum retroreflectivity levels. If a sign falls below that, it gets replaced even if it looks fine during the day. Because the whole point of retroreflectivity is that the sign is visible at night in your headlights, and you can't judge that by looking at it in daylight.
There's a guy whose job is to drive around with a retroreflectometer and test signs. That's a real job title.
Sign reflectivity technician. I know you loved that when we first came across it, and in the Arctic, they do it in the dark for half the year, in conditions where the retroreflectometer itself can freeze up if you're not careful. The manual specifies keeping the device inside your coat until the moment you use it.
All of this engineering depends on someone actually installing it right. Hilbert, you've done this job, haven't you?
The washers. Nobody talks about the washers.
What about them?
Every bolt on a sign gantry gets a hardened steel washer, flat on one side, beveled on the other. The bevel faces the nut. If you put it on backwards, flat side to the nut, the bolt can loosen under vibration within 6 months. The bevel creates a spring effect. It compresses slightly and maintains tension as the joint settles. Flat side doesn't do that.
If the washer's backwards, the whole bolt can back out.
My uncle's cousin ran a highway sign crew in northern Minnesota. Summer of 94, I torqued bolts on gantry anchor plates for a stretch of US 53 near the Canadian border. I must have done 2,000 bolts. He made me check every single washer with a feeler gauge before the nut went on. If the feeler gauge caught the edge, the washer was backwards. Flip it, try again.
2,000 bolts. And the torque spec?
450 foot-pounds. We used a pneumatic impact wrench. Ingersoll Rand, the big one, weighed about 30 pounds and calibrated it every morning with a torque transducer. You'd hang the transducer off a test bolt, run the wrench until it clicked, check the reading. If it was off by more than 5%, you adjusted the air pressure regulator and did it again.
Calibrated every morning.
Temperature changes the viscosity of the pneumatic oil. Cold morning, the wrench runs different than a warm afternoon. You don't calibrate in the morning. You're under-torquing the first 40 bolts and over-tightening the last 40. My uncle's cousin, his name was Dale, he said a gantry with one under-torqued bolt might stand for 10 years and then fail in the first big windstorm, and you'd never know which bolt it was.
The failure is invisible until it isn't.
I still check them when I drive under a gantry. Not that I can see the washers from the ground. But I look at the base plates, see if there's any rust staining around the bolt heads. Rust staining means water got in, which means the bolts lost preload. It's a curse. I can't not look.
The thing I keep coming back to is that every single one of those bolts was torqued by someone. Someone stood there with a 30-pound impact wrench and did it 2,000 times, and if they put one washer on backwards, the whole structure could eventually fail. That's the kind of invisible precision the world runs on.
Dale also said the signs themselves weigh more than you think. A full overhead sign panel, 12 by 20 feet, 3/16 aluminum with the stiffeners, that's around 800 pounds. You lift it with a crane, and the wind catches it, and suddenly you're fighting 800 pounds of aluminum sail. We did one install in a crosswind where the panel got away from the crane operator and swung into the gantry truss. Put a 6-inch dent in the stiffener rib. Dale made us lower it back down and replace the whole panel. Said the dent would create a stress riser and the rib would crack eventually.
He was right. A dent in an extruded stiffener rib is exactly the kind of thing that initiates a fatigue crack. The rib is under tension when the wind loads the panel, and any geometric discontinuity concentrates the stress.
Dale was right about most things. He also said the reflective sheeting on those signs was rated for 12 years, but the bolts would outlast the sheeting by a factor of 3. So you'd be up there replacing the sign face while the structure underneath was still perfectly good. He thought that was wasteful. Wanted to design a sign with a replaceable face panel that clipped onto the truss so you didn't need a crane. Never got anyone to fund it.
A clip-on highway sign. That's actually a good idea.
He thought so. He's dead now, so he's not going to see it happen.
The replaceable face panel idea connects to something we were talking about earlier. The Arctic signs with the sacrificial acrylic layer. Same principle, different environment. You design the thing that degrades fastest to be swappable without replacing the whole structure.
Dale would have liked that. He was always trying to make things easier for the next crew. He'd mark the torque values on the base plates with a paint pen, so the inspection crew 5 years later knew what they were looking at. Most of those paint pen marks are probably still there.
As autonomous vehicles take over, I wonder whether signage will shift from human readability to machine-readable markers. Some states are already testing RFID tags embedded in signposts for vehicle-to-infrastructure communication. The car doesn't need to see the sign. It just reads the tag and knows there's a stop ahead.
The interesting question is whether that changes the physical engineering. If the sign is primarily for machines, do you still need the retroreflective sheeting? Do you still need the ceramic enamel? Or do you just need a ruggedized RFID tag on a post and the visual sign becomes a backup?
The visual sign will probably stick around for a long time as a redundancy layer. But the engineering might shift. If the sign is no longer the primary communication channel, the failure tolerance changes. A sign that's slightly delaminated but still has a functioning RFID tag is fine. A sign that's perfectly readable but has a dead tag is a problem.
That inverts the whole inspection regime. Instead of checking retroreflectivity, you're checking signal strength. Instead of replacing the sign face when it fades, you're replacing the tag when the battery dies, assuming it's an active tag. Passive RFID doesn't need a battery, but the read range is shorter. There's a whole new set of engineering trade-offs coming.
For now, though, the next time you drive under a highway gantry, look at the bolts. Someone torqued every one of them to a specific value, and if they put a washer on backwards, the whole thing could come down. That's the kind of invisible engineering the world runs on.
Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flemingtop for keeping us on schedule and for the washer story, which I'm going to think about every time I'm on a highway now.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want to send us a question like Daniel did, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show my weird prompts where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.